Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekday news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Utah could be in for a whale of a ski season. There's just one problem. A mining CEO bought 74,000 shares days before President Trump shrank bear's ears. House Democrats want answers. And wholly unqualified, a Utah anti-trafficking group shouldn't have received a $244 million legal services contract, a critic says. Joining me today on the program are Salt Lake Tribune politics reporter Robert Gerke. Robert, thanks for joining us.
Great. Good to be here, Tom. Good morning.
Good morning. Outdoors reporter Julie Jagg is with us. Thanks, Julie.
Appreciate you having me. Sorry, my voice is a little froggy.
We'll do our best. Thank you.
Yeah.
And water and land use reporter Leah Larson is with us. So, Leah, thank you.
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning. Let's start with Robert Gerke. Here's the headline again. Wholly unqualified, Utah anti-trafficking group shouldn't have received a legal services contract, critic says. It's $244 million worth. So this contract was awarded to Our Rescue. First of all, tell us what Our Rescue is.
Right. We've talked about this group on the show before. It used to be Operation Underground Railroad. It's the anti-child trafficking group that was founded by Tim Ballard. Obviously, a few years back, they parted ways with Tim Ballard because of the allegations of sexual assault and misconduct. And so it's been trying to continue this anti-trafficking mission, largely partnering with local police departments, providing them with equipment for, you know, to combat trafficking and so forth. Last Friday, they were awarded a almost $250 million contract by the Department of Health and Human Services to provide legal services to minors who are unaccompanied as they come across the border and are in custody or care of the department. And so, you know, this is raising a lot of questions now because they don't seem to have provided this type of service before. It's not mentioned anywhere on their website. They did not answer questions when I asked about whether they have any attorneys on staff who are, you know, experienced in this or if they've ever provided this kind of service before. But and that's why, as the headline said, you know, the one of the groups that has been providing these services in the past, it's a Amica Center for Justice, I believe is what the name was. You know, they say they're wholly unqualified to do it, that they don't have the resources or the experience or the personnel or the network that would be needed to make sure that these kids are getting the services, to the legal representation they're entitled to as they make their way through the immigration system. And to be clear, some people listeners might be asking, well, why are we providing them legal services? Well, in 2003, Congress, in almost unanimous, I believe it may have been unanimous in the Senate, passed legislation that was signed into law by President George W. Bush to say that, you know, these kids, to help them through the legal process and pursue these legal avenues that might be available to them, are should be given some legal representation. And so since 2003, this has been in place, but the Trump administration did not like the provider who was providing the legal services. They stopped paying them back in November or December, I believe. And then on July 31st, canceled the contract just ahead of obviously awarding a new contract for this to Our Rescue.
Who has been providing these services in Utah?
Yeah, there's a network of almost 100 providers across the country, in each state, and Catholic Community Services is the sole provider here in Utah. The way it's worked before, Acacia is the vendor that had the contract before, would then, you know, coordinate that with the local council to represent, again, these minors who have come across the border and are undocumented.
So what happened after the contracts were terminated? Did providers keep doing this work pro bono?
Yeah, so the provider I talked to from Akima, which is an organization based in Washington, D.C., he said they have a moral and ethical obligation to continue to provide the services to the clients that they have. And to get a sense of the scope of this, I guess, there's about 24,000 open cases currently. So these are kids who've been placed either like in basically foster homes, or some of them are in government custody. About 1,900 of them are in government custody and in government facilities, awaiting their day in immigration court, you know. And so the concern obviously expressed by some of these advocates is that you know, these kids are going to be facing these kind of high state court hearings and not even speak the language and not understand the process or the options that are available. You know, they could apply for asylum or, you know, refugee status, things like that. And the end goal, according to the provider that I talked to, seems to be to expedite deportations, get more of them shipped back to their countries of origin, more expeditiously, rather than to make sure that they're given the legal options and legal avenues that they are entitled to under the law.
How many children are we talking about?
Yeah, as I mentioned, it's about 24,000 open
24,000.
cases,
Okay.
24,000 open cases
Yeah.
nationwide. Yeah,
Yeah.
I don't know how many of them are in Utah. It seems that, and this kind of goes without saying, that the largest number of them seem to be in Texas, California, and Arizona.
So presumably our rescue is going to have to gear up, hire attorneys, and get going with this.
Yeah, under the terms of the contract, they've got about 120 days to get their ducks in a row, I guess, in the sense of, you know, identifying the local providers that they would be working with. Then those providers are required to meet with each of the clients that they would be representing and report back to HHS that, you know, that they've met the terms of that. The contract itself is, like I said, up to $244 million. It's 158 million guaranteed, plus there are options for extensions on it.
Tell us briefly remind us the history. Operation Underground Railroad has become our rescue, for
Yeah,
those who have forgotten.
Tim Ballard founded Operation Underground Railroad in 2013, built it into a pretty formidable organization in terms of fundraising, and they raised about $50 million. But in the final year he was there, but you know, it was kind of got sucked into this Tim Ballard scandal where he was allegedly sexually assaulting multiple women who were operators on these missions that they would go on. He denied any wrongdoing, claimed it was part of the couple's ruse that they would use, but the OUR at the time, it was still called that, did an investigation into it and, you know, ousted him from that position. The board wanted him gone. Since then, you know, Tim's continued to do some of this anti-trafficking work through other entities and organizations. You remember, I'm sure, Tim Ballard from the movie Sound of Freedom, but raised about $250 million in tickets across the globe. You know, turned him into a pretty major celebrity in certain circles. So he, like I said, is not associated with our rescue, which they rebranded as after his departure. And so, you know, it's interesting because Tim obviously has a lot of ties to the Trump administration, including they screened his movie at Mar-a-Lago with the president, and you know, other close ties to the president. He was on the White House anti-trafficking task force when he was still, you know, before. Official and ICE official from Trump's first administration. He's the current CEO of our rescue now, and said that, you know, they are committed to making sure that kids get the representation they deserve, you know, because they're vulnerable children. Some of them potentially have been trafficked themselves, and so he thinks that this is a good fit for them.
Should note, as you do in the story, Tim Ballard, there have been no criminal charges, and some of the civil lawsuits have been dropped. O
Correct.
others are continuing, I guess.
Correct. There were a series of civil lawsuits that were filed for various reasons against both him and OUR, our rescue. And some of them have been dropped. Both SimGil and the Utah County Attorney investigated it, whether there were grounds for criminal charges, and declined to file charges.
Well, Robert Gerke is with us, politics reporter at Salt Lake Tribune. We have time for a bit of this story. Utahns are getting a break at the pump, but did anyone actually notice? I'll confess, I didn't really notice and missed this at the legislature. The state's giving us a break from state gas tax for a while.
Yeah, this was something that House Speaker Mike Schultz and Representative Cal Roberts were spearheading. You know, they were trying to target this affordability issue that everybody seems or everybody talks a lot about or is concerned about. And they initially wanted a much larger gas tax break, and they were going to start taxing gas that is refined here in Utah. Utah has five refineries and exports a lot of it to Idaho, and they wanted to tax those exports. Obviously, Idaho didn't like that. They said it would be a big hit for their residents in that state, and actually threatened to cut off water flowing into Utah from Idaho in retaliation to it. So the Speaker and Representative Roberts backed down. It settled on a much more modest tax break, a temporary tax break that kicked in on July 1st. Sorry, about 6 cents a gallon is what the break was. But obviously, with the situation in, you know, the Strait of Hormuz, where, you know, the shipments have been cut down, imports of oil have been cut off in large part, and our gas prices have shot through the roof. So the 6 cents a gallon, you know, I talked to a couple people who were filling up at the pumps, and they hadn't noticed it. Sounds like you didn't notice it. I didn't really notice it. I knew it kicked in, but it's hard when gas prices go up by about a dollar a gallon in the span of a little over a month to really feel the 6 cent break. I guess it could be $1.06 a gallon instead of a dollar, but that's where we are right now. Yeah. And this gas tax holiday runs through the end of the year, at which point the gas tax resets. It's all indexed based on the cost of living. And Representative Roberts believes it will remain lower, and you know, after they reset it at the first of the year, but that part remains to be seen, I guess.
Well, if we're getting a tax break, and hey, we'll take it, that means less revenue coming in. So how's that going to affect things?
Correct. That you know, and I should note, I guess, you know, I asked Representative Roberts, it's like, well, you know, was it worth doing, you know, if people aren't really noticing it? And he says that with the prices as high as they are, it's needed now more than ever. You know, if we need to give some relief to Utah consumers, he says it's going to keep, I guess, about $45 million in, you know, consumers' wallets over the course of the 6 month, roughly, span of the gas tax holiday. Part of that means that there will be some local transportation projects and maintenance projects and so forth on local roads that might have to be postponed a little bit, because the gas tax money, as you probably know, does significantly fund the transportation projects that get done. So you know, I mean, it's a little give and take, I suppose. But he says it was still worth doing, the right thing to do, and like I said, needed at this point now more than ever.
So one more thing on this, state leaders want refineries to be pumping out more gasoline, right? I guess part of that hope is that would help prices go down.
Yeah. So the gas tax break was just part of a larger bill. There's some permitting reform that they want done to make sure that we can get pipelines permitted and, you know, refinery expansions permitted more quickly. And so hopefully they can start pumping out more gas. There was also a commitment from the industry to produce about 23,000 more barrels a day. They're moving in that direction. They're producing now about 6,000 more barrels a day than they were, you know, at the beginning of the year. And there's a pipeline that says they're going to start importing more refined gas from Wyoming. So it's possible that we could see more gas on the market. The thinking in Representative Roberts' mind is that, you know, when you have more supply, and the price will drop. It's kind of hard, you know, we got to see how that works, because right now, as I mentioned, Utah produces a lot more gas than it consumes, and exports about 75,000 barrels of refined fuel a day to our neighboring states. And so producing an extra 23,000, are we going to be exporting more of that? Are we going to actually see relief at the pumps? Is the demand going to increase to accommodate that? It sort of remains to be seen. And as that comes online, I guess we'll see how it plays out.
And
I should note, I
yeah,
should
go
note right now, right now the Utah refineries are operating at full capacity because, they're trying to offset some of the fuel that we're losing from what's happening in the Middle East. So, we've lost a lot of imports from Saudi Arabia, for example. So it is, they're operating at full capacity now. They don't always operate at full capacity because they don't want to flood the market with fuel that nobody really wants or needs.
One more thing of this, Robert. As you reminded us, the history here, Utah and Idaho usually get along very well. This this threatened to start a skirmish between the two states. I guess things have settled down. Utah did back off of their plan.
Yeah. As I mentioned, Idaho was not happy about the notion that Utah might tax the exports to Idaho. It would be basically Idaho consumers paying a tax to Utah, and they thought, A, that was unconstitutional under the Commerce Clause, but also B, that it was just an unfair hit. And so that's when they threatened to, divert water that flows across from Idaho to Utah and down to the Great Salt Lake. It was kind of the nuclear option. They've kind of conti they haven't completely abandoned the notion of that though, and have commissioned a study on on how that water might be used by Idaho rather than, letting it go untapped. And so, they're kind of keeping that in their back pocket in case there's another attempt to try to impose that tax. But yeah, Utah did back down on that. Said that, at the end of the session, the speaker was saying they have a good relationship with the officials in Idaho and hope to work well with them in the future. So, it could flare up again. We'll see how it goes. But as of right now, they, like I said, settled on this more modest tax relief, but a relief that, like we have discussed, a lot of consumers didn't know actually was put in place and aren't really feeling the full benefits of.
Well, I guess now we know. So that's
Yep.
hope that'll make us feel better. We've been talking with Salt Lake Tribune politics reporter Robert Gerke on the program. Robert, thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Tom. Take care.
I know we need to let you go do some reporting. So thanks. Appreciate it.
Yep. All right. We'll see you soon.
See you. You are listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. And when we come back, here is the headline: Utah could be in for a whale of a ski season. There's just one problem. We'll find out what that problem is. And we'll be talking with Salt Lake Tribune outdoors reporter Julie Jagg. We'll have more following this break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. We turn next to Salt Lake Tribune outdoors reporter Julie Jagg. Julie, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me here.
So here's the headline: Utah could be in for a whale of a ski season. There's just one problem. And there is a video here of the whale on 9th and 9th in Salt Lake City during a snowstorm, December of 2022. But that's not the whale you're talking about.
Well, no. I mean, we all have to hail the whale for bringing us snow every time it happens. But no, the whale that I'm talking about is the kind of whale-shaped form that shows where precipitation is going to be brought in by something called the Super El Nino, which is what we're expected this year. So to have this year. So but it kind of forms this like whale shaped form pattern that mostly covers Utah, which is very exciting for skiers around here.
So yeah, it does look like a whale. It has parts of California. Nevada is entirely covered. Utah mostly, Arizona, New Mexico, and parts of Colorado. So
I'm glad you see it because, I wasn't sure at first when I wrote about it. I was like, I see a whale. But
yeah.
Others, what kind of test is this? But
Yeah, it
I
does.
saw a
It
whale.
does look like a whale. And the whale shape is where, with this El Nino predicted, we'll have above normal snowfall. Further north, there's Canada and then the extreme northern states should be below normal. So El Nino and Super El Nino, tell us about that.
So, I mean, the El Nino, I think it's a term we all know of, just kind of as a general weather term, but maybe not quite understand what it means. And I'm not pretending to be a meteorologist for sure. But basically what happens is some warm, the water warms up around South America in this area called the Nino 3.4 index, to get very technical. And it warms up, and the warmer it gets, then the stronger El Nino will have. And for those who want to know, the cooler it gets, then the stronger La Nina will have. So in this case, if it's a 0.5 or above, it's an El Nino year. And this year, the NOAA expects it to be 1.8, I think is what they're saying now. So quite a bit higher than 0.5, above normal temperatures. And so that means that they're expecting, they're predicting a super El Nino, which, you know, brings a lot of moisture generally to our area, but also, you know, not to give too many things away, but it's kind of a warm winter as well.
Ah, okay. I just want to give credit here to Evan Thayer, Open Snows, Utah forecaster. One of the quotes of the year, generally, El Nino is generally acting like an ex who can't commit to a pattern. You wrote in a blog post. I love that. So El Nino sometimes is paid off and sometimes not.
Exactly. Yeah. And I do want to, you know, say that this article came from a forecast issued by Open Snow for their, they kind of did one for the entire world. But we've had great El Nino years. Utah really gets in this like weird area where people, you know, earlier this year were like, oh, it's a super El Nino, it's going to be amazing. But it's not always. Sometimes it skips us. We're like Utah, especially the Wasatch, is really in this like weird zone where we can get a great El Nino if it happens, or it might not happen at all. But this year looks like it's supposed to happen. And yeah, so like Evan was saying, it's fluky, as I like to say, because of the whale. But the 82-83 season, which until recently was our snowiest season ever with 637 inches, that was a strong El Nino year. But we've also had strong El Nino years where we've gotten less than 400 inches up at Alta. And that's not a great year generally considered. So it can go either way.
So we'd love to, there's a photo here of the, this is from January 23. So the 22-23 season, snowboarders are walking, being dwarfed by a wall of snow that's been plowed to the side. That's what we want, I guess.
It should be noted that was not a strong El Nino year. That was actually the end of a third straight La Nina year. So, that was not caused by a super El Nino.
Okay. But El Ninos sometimes produce, I guess, snow similar to that every once in a while. I guess the problem that we referenced in the headline is it's also probably going to be, might be warm, too warm for snow.
Exactly. Yeah. So as exciting as it is, and, you know, all us skiers and snowboarders are very excited about this season, especially after last season. But yeah, kind of the downer is that El Ninos are warm, and this one is a super El Nino, so it's probably especially warm. And so we may have, it's possible to have the same issue that we had last year, which was that the lower elevation resorts or the bases of resorts will not be cold enough to make snow. And so this beautiful snow that might fall may also fall as rain. So two problems in one, I guess.
So meteorologist Alan Smith, I guess from Open Snow, gives us a little bit of hope. He says this last year, which was bad for snow, was well above average temperatures. He said that it might just be above average.
Yep, that's the hope. So we'll cling to that, I think. Evan, I talked to Evan as well, Evan Thayer, as we mentioned before, and he said, yeah, it's possible that we'll have the same as last year. But Alan seems to think that maybe this year will be a little different. And he even said that El Nino seems to really like Park City. So Those aren't particularly high elevation resorts, but if everything comes together, they might have a great season.
Okay, we'll cross our fingers and hope that this
Yeah.
Super El Nino delivers this time around.
As usual, we'll be waiting until the actual snow flies to know if we will
Yeah,
have a great ski season or
right.
not.
We're talking with outdoors reporter Julie Jagg. Time for one more story here. Paris had the Seine. Utah's Olympic plans have something else to worry about. The Seine was dirty. In fact, some people got sick from swimming in it. There was a race to clean up the Seine before the Paris Olympics, and they didn't quite make it.
That's right. I'm going to veer off for a second and tell you kind of a funny story. So that I covered the Paris Olympics, and I was very excited because I'm an open water swimmer that they were going to open the Seine for swimming, and then I found out that they were not opening it for swimming, and in fact, we're still finding out it was polluted. But I went in anyway. I did not grow a third arm or get any warts or anything, as far as I know. But then later, I found out they actually had opened it up parts of it for a public. So there you
Yeah.
go.
Well, let me diverge here just briefly. That's fascinating. You're an open water swimmer. What long distances or what
No,
have you done?
nothing like. I'm not doing the English Channel or anything like that. But formerly lived by the ocean, and just as cold as it was just always felt great to get in there. So
No,
definitely I've
great.
had some seals poking at my toes when I've swam before, and just kind of probably a mile or two is the longest I've gone. I did Alcatraz twice, so that'll be my humble brag.
Okay, well, that's impressive. So the Seine was cleaned up after a year after the Olympics. So in Utah, we're talking about air quality, obviously. And there's some researchers at Utah State University who are putting forth a plan.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so I mean that's kind of the concern, is that the Seine, they embarked on it to clean it up about the same time, about as many years out as we are now from the 2034 Olympics, and they did not get it cleaned in time. It was still a year later that they actually opened it to the for public swimming. So that's kind of what these researchers looking at that were wondering, like how, like will we be able to do this in time? And so they set forth, it was Edwin Stafford, Rosalind Brain McCann, and Randy Martin, like you said, of Utah State. And so they set forth in a paper some ideas for cleaning up Utah's air, which they see as the biggest problem, the Seine for Utah, before the 2034 Olympics. And a lot of this have to do with basically ideas that have been around for a long time.
Tell me a few of those ideas.
Yeah, a lot of them are just basically getting people into electric vehicles, increasing bus and public transportation use. Let's see here, what else? Electrifying buildings, just making things more energy efficient, more or less.
Part of the story here, you have an expert who points out you went and got these statistics, which make me feel a little inferior here in Utah. 73% of Utah's electricity comes from renewable sources. South Dakota is more than 80%. I don't think Utah's there.
No, exactly. Yeah, 73% in Idaho. Yeah, South Dakota more than 80, and we have. Let me look at my notes here. I can't quite remember, but we are not even close to that. I believe it was close to 40%. I'm not seeing it here, but yeah, but yeah, Utah is quite a ways. Yeah, so Utah relies on 70% of coal, or relies on coal for half of its electricity. Yeah, sorry.
In the story, you point out that the Olympic Committee has an agreement with the International Olympic Committee to do a lot of these things, but that footprint is not statewide, right? It's certainly not what is needed, I think these researchers are saying.
Well, yeah, I mean, it is great that the IOC now requires that, and they now don't just have to be net neutral, they have to be net positive environmentally. But the issue is that only applies to areas within the what they call the games perimeter, basically. So it's just like at the events, basically. So they don't have to worry about the transportation between the events or people coming into Utah that will create additional pollution, probably. They will use additional natural gas, those kind of things. So they just have to worry about what's happening actually at the events, which is fair because that's all they can probably control, but this will not necessarily clean up Utah's air.
Frazier Bullock's quoted in your story as remembering, I hadn't remembered this, but they just kind of lucked out in 2002, right? The inversion the day before, and then a storm came through, and it was clear air for the rest of the games.
Right, yeah. Early on, when they were launching this bid, he told me it was one of his biggest top priorities, biggest concerns, is having inversion again, because they really feel like the optics of that would cast a pall on the 2034 games. If you're trying to show beautiful, you know, Rice-Eccles Stadium and it's all covered in brown, or you can't even see the mountains beyond it, that's not going to be a great look. So it is something they're concerned about, and something they say they're working with lawmakers, liaising, I think was their word, with lawmakers and city leaders and county leaders to improve. But it's just kind of a question of whether that will all happen in time, whether people will realize, or whether we'll even have the ability to implement these changes in time to make a difference.
Well, in this part of the program, we've been talking with Salt Lake Tribune Outdoors reporter Julie Jagg. Julie, thank you.
Thank you.
And you are listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. Following a break, we'll be talking about this headline. A mining CEO bought 74,000 shares days before President Trump shrank Bears ears. House Democrats want answers. We'll be talking with water and land use reporter Leah Larson following this break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. We bring in now Salt Lake Tribune water and land use reporter Leah Larson. Leah, thank you.
Hey there. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you on. So here's the headline once again. A mining CEO bought 74,000 shares days before Trump shrank Bears ears. House Democrats want answers. So tell me about the company and the CEO.
Yeah. What to say about the company? The company owns the White Mesa Mill down in San Juan County, where they process uranium. It's about a mile east of the boundary, or the former boundary, I guess now, of the Bears ears National Monument. And we know that they have interest in the uranium deposits that are within the Bears ears National Monument, so at least its former boundaries. Because back in 2017, when the Trump administration shrunk the boundaries a first time, the Washington Post obtained a letter that showed that executives of this company had written letters to the Trump administration and to Senator Orrin Hatch, Utah's former Republican senator, talking about how this monument was a threat to their business, and how they wanted specific areas within the monument they wanted to be able to access for mining purposes. And then 6 months later, sure enough, the monument was downsized. So I think when we heard it was downsized again just last month, we were kind of waiting for the other shoe to drop. Was this done as kind of a handout to mining companies? And while I don't know that we have like concrete evidence that that's the case, I think this sudden purchase of stock raises questions, at least for congressional Democrats. They're investigating.
So, yeah, tell me about the House Democrats' concerns.
Well, I think, like you said, the CEO of Energy Fuels bought thousands of shares just days before this reduction happened. So the timing was a little interesting, especially given the history there. And it wasn't just the CEO, also the board chair bought a bunch of shares, about 4,000. So this was like the biggest insider trade in the company's history, I believe. So the timing is just interesting. But they have been doing other things. They've kind of ramped up their mill to also produce and process critical minerals, which both the Trump and Biden administration singled out as an important thing to do to like develop domestically, so we're not so dependent on foreign sources of these materials that we use in everything from cars to like microchips to aviation to defense. So that was a priority for both administrations. So they announced they were ramping up production of those in a few months, and that caused our stock to actually soar just within the last few months. But yeah, I think what the congressional Democrats want to know is what's with the timing of this? Why did this happen just like days before this? Was this a coincidence? They don't seem to think so. They want the company's communications with federal administration members, and they also are trying to get more information on their lobbying contracts to see what kind of ties may have been there.
Yeah, I guess the timing raises questions, and I guess the question, did the company have prior knowledge, right? That's supposed to be a no-no, right?
Yeah, I mean, it sure maybe seems that way, especially given again that history in 2017 where they were actually consulted and like pressuring the Trump administration to reduce the monument in certain ways and exclude certain areas. We don't know if that happened this time around, but we know what happened in the past. I just think it's interesting, but investigation is apparently warranted according to the Democrats. I mean, their proximity, I mean, they're very close to the Bears Ears National Monument. They've expressed that they're aware that there's uranium materials within the monument that they would like to access. So, I did reach out to them for comment. They said everything they're doing is above board, that they're taking this investigation very seriously. But we'll see if they comply with these subpoena requests.
I think they also said, look, we even with the expanded boundaries, we weren't within the thing we had. They said they had no current leases
They had no
or such.
current claims, but there were existing claims within the monument that aren't necessarily owned by Energy Fuels, but they have expressed interest in those existing claims. And who knows, probably new ones, because we know like these sandstone deposits in the Colorado Plateau are rich in uranium. There was a, the uranium boom in like the 40s and 50s near Moab. We know those materials are there. And I think it's kind of interesting because back in 2017, again, when it was shrunk the first time, the then Interior Secretary Robert Zinke, or sorry, Ryan Zinke, was traveling around, meeting with people, meeting with tribes, meeting with communities and stakeholders, and doing kind of listening sessions. And he said, there were all these accusations, and when the monument was downsized drastically, that this was a handout to the energy industry, and he denied that. He said there's no oil and gas reserves in Bears Ears. This isn't what it was for. But of course, there was no mention of uranium. And the timing's really great right now because both the state of Utah as well as the Trump administration 2.0 have really prioritized developing nuclear energy as they see this as the future. They want to build nuclear plants, these small modular reactors. Are really seen as the answer to the surge in energy demand we're projecting because all these data centers are coming online. And I know you and I, Tom, have talked a lot about data centers in the last year. They seem to be popping up everywhere across Utah and across the nation, and they are big energy sinks, and nuclear it seems to be what a lot of government officials think is a solution. So we'll see.
Remind us, this is a mill, so they take uranium and I think vanadium, is that how you say it, and they process it. Is that what happens?
Yeah, the material has to be refined so it can be used. I think they store some radioactive waste as well on site. They have these big ponds, and there have been concerns among members of the Navajo Nation, which neighbor this mill, that it's contaminating water. Because water is such a precious resource in this very, very dry part of the state. A lot of members of the Navajo Nation don't have access to clean water because their aquifer has been so contaminated just with the extractive industries over many, many decades. Like I have been to like Bluff. There's a ministry there where people will drive in every day and just fill up like milk jugs full with water from this clean well, and they'll bring tanks and things because they just don't have access to it on the reservation there. So they've long contested that this mill is not a good neighbor. And the House Democrats, when they wrote a letter to the CEO of Energy Fuels calling for this investigation and demanding these records and these communications, they did kind of like rail them for being a bad neighbor and causing pollution. Like, they had some pretty strong words. Let's see. Like, they said, this mill functions like an unregulated bargain bin waste dump on the doorstep of an indigenous community. So pretty strongly worded letter.
So you referenced this a little bit. I wonder if you could expand this kind of last thing of this. Utah is a finalist to be the nation's one of the nation's first nuclear life cycle innovation campuses.
Yes. So when Energy Fuels, they did a investor presentation right ahead of the monument getting shrunk. And they touted like their government support as like one of their assets as they're, going to investors and shareholders. And so, we know they have a lot of support from the Trump administration. The Department of Defense, which they're calling the Department of War, gave them hundreds of millions of dollars to help develop these critical minerals that they've just expanded to process. And then, like I said, that the state of Utah has really gone all in on energy development in the state, and particularly nuclear. So yes, they are applying to become a federal campus. They call them, we talked about this before several weeks ago, but like nuclear innovation life cycle campuses, where they're going to do everything from process uranium to recycle spent fuels to store radioactive materials. They're going to handle every step of the way. And so when the state applied to be one of these with the federal government, it touted White Mesa Mill, one of its many assets in the state, for why we should be the home to one of these massive campuses. And Energy Fuels is definitely aware that the government supports them, and they shared that with their investors.
So these are Democrats in the House calling for investigations. They're in the minority, so I guess they don't have
They
the
are.
subpoena power, I would think, but I guess they are calling for investigations.
Yes, that we'll see what comes of it, because like you said, they are in the minority. But I just think this goes to the bigger ping pong match that the Bears Ears Monument is kind of in the middle of, like where you have Democrats, which are more liberal politicians, where they want to preserve these big open spaces, and they want to kind of make amends with indigenous communities and how they've been exploited in the past. And Bears Ears was supposed to be like a big olive branch in that regard, and like this just like this big act preserves some of our last wild open spaces. But then you have more conservative politicians who see resource extraction and energy development as an issue of national security. And Bears Ears has just been in the middle of this back and forth for more than a decade. And I just think it's interesting, though, the first time around when it was shrunk, like I said, the Interior Secretary was meeting with all these stakeholders and things. But this time around, that didn't happen. The announcement just came very suddenly. It didn't seem like anybody was consulted, and it was reduced even more than the first time around. So we'll see, who is in the White House next, and what happens, what the fate of this will be. And I'm sure, of course, there's going to be lawsuits. Like, can a president just unilaterally reduce the size of a monument in this way? I don't think that we've fully answered that question.
All right, we'll keep an eye on this. We've been talking with the Water and Land Use Reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune, Leah Larson. Leah, thank you.
You bet.
It's time for our underplayed stories of the week. So, Julie Jagg, what's your underplayed story?
I'm going to give a shout out to Jason Battacchio from our sports team. He wrote the story about Devin Dampier that has gotten me pretty excited about the upcoming college football season. It's just about why Dampier is coming back to possibly be the Utes, likely be the Utes quarterback, and kind of the changes in institutional, I guess, changes that Morgan Scalley is putting into the team. So yeah, makes me excited to for the season to come.
All right, we'll see how the Utes do. Leah Larson, what's your underplayed story?
So mine is, back to the data centers. They're a big topic of discussion, and there was a story by Notus, that's Notus, they're a content sharing partner we have at the Tribune, but they did a really interesting story analysis of like the national bipartisan backlash to data centers. So even though the Trump administration is giving these data centers full-throated support and, you know, tried to open up federal lands for building data centers and things, even his own constituents and supporters are very anti-data center. So it's a really great exploration of that and how that happened. So it is on our website, even though it's from a partner. Check it out.
All right, sltrib.com for those stories, sltrib.com. Well, we thank Robert Gerke, who had to leave, go do some reporting, politics reporter. We thank Julie Jagg, outdoors reporter. Thank you.
It was fun being here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And water and land use reporter Leah Larson, thank you.
Yeah, great chatting with you.
Good to chat with you as well. And you have been listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Hope you'll be with me again next time. Thanks for listening.